Welcome to The Morning Magazine for Tuesday, May 23rd. I'm Sam Fuqua, filling in for Shannon Young. Coming up today after the headlines, we're going to check in with the Alliance Center. They've been bringing nonprofits and people together for almost 20 years here in Colorado. The world's largest lakes are getting smaller. That story and more on This Week in Water. How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show comes your way every Tuesday morning just after the 8:30 BBC headlines. Today on the Science Show, bee biology, the biology of the bees. And then the wit and wisdom of Alan Watts at 9. Our day of diverse music begins at 9:30 with the Morning Sound Alternative. All still ahead, all made possible by the listener members of KGNU. Thanks, members. We begin, as always, with state and local headlines. Here's Stacy Johnson.
Three law enforcement agencies, along with the state of Colorado, have agreed to pay the family of a police shooting victim a $19 million settlement. Law enforcement fatally shot 22-year-old Christian Glass after Glass crashed his car into a berm near Silver Plume last summer and then dialed the emergency number for help. The largest portion of the settlement, $10 million, will come from Clear Creek County, whose former deputy shot and killed Glass. Other law enforcement agencies that had officers at the scene include Georgetown, Idaho Springs, the Colorado State Patrol, and the Division of Gaming. According to Colorado Public Radio, the settlement is the largest known single payout for police violence in the state's history. In 2021, the family of Elijah McClain received $15 million. As part of the settlement, the agencies agreed to implement several police reform and mental health training initiatives. Among other commitments, Clear Creek County will also dedicate a public park in honor of Glass, and the state will feature Glass's artwork in government buildings. Three out of seven western states that rely on the Colorado River for water are signing a landmark drought deal. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
The states of California, Arizona, and Nevada said Monday that they are willing to cut back on their use of the dwindling Colorado River water through 2026, when current guidelines for how the river is shared expire. The Colorado Sun reports that these three states that make up the lower basin of the river will do so in exchange for money from the federal government, and to avoid forced cuts as the drought threatens key water supply for the West. The 1,450-mile-long river provides water to 40 million people in seven U.S. states, parts of Mexico, and more than two dozen Native American tribes. It produces hydropower and supplies water to farms that grow most of the nation's winter vegetables. In exchange for temporarily using less water, cities, irrigation districts, and Native American tribes in the three states will be paid. Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, the four states that make up the upper basin of the river system, said they supported the submission of the agreement. However, they have not yet endorsed the plan. For KGNU, I'm Steve Miller.
Several Aurora City Council members, state representatives from Aurora, and officials from the city's police and fire unions held a news conference Monday to announce their unified opposition to a proposed ballot initiative that would give the city's mayor significant authority and power as the city's top executive. Supporters are currently collecting signatures for the proposal to become a ballot initiative for the fall election. The proposed restructuring of the city's government seeks to give veto power to the mayor, reduce term limits for council members and the mayor, while also adding an at-large member seat to the city council. The proposal would also eliminate the city manager position and give the mayor authority to appoint and fire staff. The Aurora Sentinel reports the proposal has drawn bipartisan criticism. Opponents say it would give too much power to one person. Supporters of strong mayor governments argue it would cut down on bureaucracy and create a more focused local government. According to the Aurora Sentinel, it is unclear who authored the controversial measure, but multiple sources told the paper Mayor Michael Kaufman was involved in creating the proposal. Kaufman did not immediately respond to the Sentinel's request for comment. Colorado is giving Boulder's Housing and Human Services funding to address and uplift community members experiencing homelessness and behavioral health crises. KGNU's Colette Czarnecki has more.
The City of Boulder announced that over $2.5 million has been awarded to Boulder's Housing and Human Services Department. These funds will serve unhoused community members and those facing behavioral health challenges. $2 million of those dollars from the Colorado Department of Local Affairs will assist future projects to support a respite center for the unhoused, where they can recover after being discharged from medical services. These clients will have access to mental health care and housing support as well. On top of the $2 million, a little over $500,000 from the Colorado Behavioral Health Administration will go towards staff and operating costs, renovations on spaces, and alternative response programs that include the Crisis Intervention Response Team and the city's new Community Assistance Response and Engagement Team. Additionally, other community partners, including Boulder Shelter for the Homeless and Mental Health Partners, received funding. The Director of Housing and Human Services, Kurt Fernhaber, said that these funds will uplift key programs to positively impact our community. For KGNU, I'm Colette Zarnicki.
Court records reveal the Colorado Mental Health Institute in Pueblo has been administering new medical therapies to the defendant in the King Super Shooter case since March. They include involuntary treatment and neuropsychological exams. Hospital doctors say the defendant is showing more engagement with his treatment. The defendant is facing murder and other criminal charges related to the March 2021 mass shooting death of 10 people that occurred at the Table Mesa King Supers in Boulder. Since the court declared him incompetent to go on trial in December 2021, the defendant has been undergoing treatment at the state mental hospital in Pueblo. The Daily Camera reports prosecutors had previously asked the state hospital to conduct neuropsych exams on the defendant, but doctors had said they were unnecessary. The recent disclosure of the treatment changes prompted prosecutors to submit an unopposed request to delay the defendant's three-day competency hearing that was to begin on Monday. Prosecutors say they had received the defendant's 200-plus pages of prior treatment records on May 1st. However, their expert witnesses were unable to finish their reports before a May 15th deadline because of the additional measures employed by the state hospital. The judge is now asking the prosecution and defense to decide on a new hearing date for late August. For today's weather, the state health department has issued an air quality alert until 4 p.m. as smoke continues to occur from the Canadian wildfires. Other than areas of smoke, skies will be sunny with highs in the upper 70s. Tonight, there is a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms before 9 p.m. For KGNU, I'm Stacey Johnson.
Well, if you spend any time in lower downtown Denver for the past almost 20 years, you might have noticed the brick building on Wynkoop, pretty close to Union Station. It's called the Alliance Center. It houses a number of nonprofit organizations. Brenna Simmons St. Ange, the executive director of the Alliance Center, is on the line with us now, and we're going to talk a little bit about how the center has evolved over almost two decades and what the future holds for this unique Denver institution. Good morning.
Good morning, Sam. Thank you so much for having me with you today, and hello to all your listeners out there.
It's impressive that the Alliance Center is now approaching 20 years in downtown Denver. Folks who might not know the building might recall the Tattered Cover had a location right next door for many years, and of course, folks know Union Station. Can you take us back to, the early part of the 2000s and what the original vision was for the Alliance Center, and then maybe move into, how that's evolved over the past couple of decades?
Absolutely. Thank you. So the Alliance Center was founded in 2004, and the original purpose is still with us today. We're conveners. And so the Alliance was founded to bring people together to identify and advance solutions for a thriving planet. And so that's what we've been doing for about 20 years now. The building itself was built in 1908. So it has been an iconic building in the historic district of downtown Denver, for over a century. And it's really interesting because it used to be a warehouse in the shipping district there when the old train station went right by it. So the building itself is just rooted in deep, deep history in Denver. And we purchased it in 2004. We actually purchased it from John Hickenlooper at the time, and that's where he launched Wynkoop Brewery from. So a lot of really interesting milestones with the building itself as a significant part in Denver's history. And when we opened our doors, really was to look at how do we intentionally create space for many different groups who are trying to work towards common goals, and how do we create a space for them to do that together, where we can break down barriers, make the most of our resources together, and have collective impact that is more than any one group could have alone. And so that was really why the organization was formed. And proud to say our very first victory coming out of the building in 2004 was Amendment 37. And that was the first renewable portfolio standard in the entire country that later became a model for the nation. So that's where we've come from. And, you know, over the years, our model has really grown to be more holistic in how we approach climate solutions and really looking at the intersection of healthy communities, healthy environments, and healthy economies in the work that we do. And, you know, nearly 20 years later, we're actually about to rebrand because our work has grown so big that the name the Alliance Center doesn't really encapsulate everything we do anymore. So we are actually launching a new brand on May 25th, and we'll be rebranding as the Alliance for Collective Action. And that's because the problems we face are so big and the solutions we need are so bold that no one organization can do it alone. So we focus on convening leaders and change agents from government, academia, for-profit, nonprofit, community, philanthropy, media, and civic leaders to first identify the largest problems we're facing and then move thought to action through community-led solutions to advance solutions for a thriving planet. And the two main ways we do that are through the center, our building, and through our coalition.
Well, let's talk about the building a little bit further and then move into the coalition. It was a co-working space long before that was a buzzword. And I remember that there were many environmental groups located there and groups working on social change in general. That's still the case, right, at the Alliance Center today?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, when we opened our doors in 2004, we were the only shared space in the greater Denver area. Now there's over 30 in one square mile from us. But we're not like a WeWork. We're much different because in order to be in the building, in order to have an event in the building, be a tenant, be a member, be part of the community, we have to be aligned on common values and common goals that look at making the world a better place and really rooted in the values of regeneration and sustainability, of healing and creating systems that enable all life to thrive. And so that is still very much with us, and we are, you know, definitely a leading shared space and collaborative working space, not just in Denver, but in the nation. And our model has actually inspired a lot of other buildings to be created that have different affinity groups around smaller groups working together towards a common purpose. And so that's absolutely true to us today. And we support about 160 organizations through the Alliance Center every year through tenancy and events. And we know that the network of our tenants is actually greatly impacted by the relationship they have with the Alliance. So we track data on that every year. And, you know, we pride ourselves as conveners. That's what we do better than anybody else. But don't just take our word for it. You know, we actually pull our network to identify what is the impact we have on their network. And we know that about 70% of our tenants' network has been curated through the Alliance Center over the years. And we also know that our network is extremely powerful in driving systemic change through policy. So we don't have data for every single year, but we did track a six-year average. And we know that through those 6 years, an average of 45 legislative victories came out of the Alliance Center tenant community in a way that advances climate change and centers this work in equity and human dignity. And that is just a beautiful example of collective action at its best.
Congratulations on that. One might ask, though, that these groups would have come together anyway out of shared interests, wouldn't they? What does it matter that they're in the same building, particularly in our wired remote working world?
You know, that's a great question. And that's something that, especially with the evolution of hybrid working space in the pandemic, that, you know, we really had to ask ourselves because our model for most of our existence was about physical convening in a physical space that's very place-based. And when the pandemic hit, I mean, we had to adapt like crazy, as everyone did, to really look at what is our relevancy in this virtual and now hybrid world. And that's really what birthed the coalition.
Well, tell us more about the coalition and the national vision. Where are you in the development process of that effort, and how can people engage?
So the coalition really was the Alliance's response to the pandemic. You know, in the before days, we would host about 450 events and bring through almost 20,000 people a year to be connected to solutions. And we had to adapt when the pandemic hit to find a way to have our power of convening be virtual. That became the coalition. And during the pandemic, we hosted a series called the Colorado Emergence Series, where we heard from hundreds of Coloradans from all walks of life, CEOs, single mothers, grocery store clerks, the governor, the lieutenant governor, hundreds of people came, and we asked them, how is COVID changing your life, and what do you want to see coming out of this pandemic to build the state forward towards a regenerative future? And through that process, again, this was the summer of 2020, we crowdsourced a bank of over 1,000 actionable ideas from real Coloradans to leverage this time of extreme upheaval and recreate systems that are in service to life. And so through that, fast forward now, we've been operating this coalition for about 2.5 years. We have over 430 members all across the great state of Colorado. They represent over 28,000 jobs in Colorado's workforce and over $7.2 billion in managed revenue. So that's not money we get, but that shows you the economic power of this coalition. And the coalition and our members have been working with us to rapidly prototype solutions that we crowdsourced from the Emergent series back in 2020. And so we tested about 20 different initiatives the last 2.5 years, and we have 4 that we're advancing that have proof of concept in Colorado. They have measurable impact at the systems level, and they're replicable, not just across our state, but across our great nation. And so those 4 projects are first focusing on the just transition to renewable and clean energy in a way that does not leave anybody behind, with a focus on equity and economic prosperity for all in this energy transition. The second is focusing on regenerative agriculture and drawing carbon out of the atmosphere by improving the health of our soils and creating more resilient food systems locally by supporting regenerative agricultural producers. The third project's actually in service to the other queue, where we focus on upskilling, reskilling, next-skilling the workforce into those 2 industries, so clean energy and regenerative agriculture. And then the 4th project, we put a nice bow around all that every year with a crowdsourced policy platform. And this I just want to spend a moment on because it's very unique and very powerful. We've been engaged in policy for nearly 20 years. But when we launched the coalition, we wanted to do things differently. So we actually started a process of crowdsourcing ideas from real Coloradans. All your listeners out there could contribute to this summer to help us for the next year's policy platform, where we crowdsource ideas, we gather ideas from hundreds of Coloradans, and then we group those into themes. And after we work with community to elevate their ideas, then we bring in policy experts to develop these policy platforms into policy language for legislators. And then we code it to where federal stimulus money is flowing. So we did 1 to CARES, 1 to ARPA. This year is to the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. And that process, Sam, over the last 2 years, helped to influence over 44 Colorado state laws. Those 44 state laws helped to direct $982 million of Colorado and federal stimulus money towards regenerative solutions that our coalition members care about, advocate for, and work on. So that's been the work of the coalition, and then that really is what's giving us wings and the fuel and power to grow nationally, given the impact that we've had in Colorado since launching this coalition. So come check us out. We'd love to meet you, thealliancecenter.org.
Brenna Simmons-St-Ange is Executive Director of the Alliance Center. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Minutes after 8 now at listener-supported KGNU. A reminder, as you might have heard a bit earlier, the Colorado Department of Public Health and the Environment has issued an air quality alert today. It's in effect till 4 p.m. There's smoke from the Canadian wildfire still coming our way, in addition to the ground-level ozone. CDPHE recommends that if you drive a gas or diesel-powered vehicle, drive as little as possible, and anybody who is in a sensitive group with respiratory issues, the elderly, etc., should be careful with outdoor activities. Again, that Air Quality Action Day for multiple pollutants is in effect until 4 p.m. this afternoon. Speaking of this afternoon, here's what's coming up on Reveal today on KGNU.
There's a new generation of anti-abortion activists.
Because we are the pro-life generation, and we are unapologetic.
They're well-funded, and they have a new target, birth control.
I do not think it should be legal. I actually think that it shouldn't be legal.
The attack on contraception on the next Reveal.
Tuesday afternoon at 4 on KGNU.
Your footprints on the beach contain your DNA. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
A new report shows we're getting much closer to living in a world that we're not used to.
The World Meteorological Organization predicts that there's almost a 100% chance that at least one of the next 5 years will be the warmest ever recorded.
They also say within the next 4 years, the chances are 2 out of 3 that for the first time, the average temperature will breach the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit imposed by the Paris Agreement. Crossing the limit will not be permanent, however, it could start to happen more frequently, even if temporarily.
The prediction is significant because it was only 8 years ago, in 2015, when the chances of temporarily exceeding this boundary were practically zero, but now they stand at 66% in the next 5 years.
The naturally occurring warming of the Pacific Ocean called El Niño and climate change will combine to heat the planet into this uncharted territory, which could lead to more severe droughts, heat waves, rainfall, and sea level rise.
More than half of the world's lakes, from the Caspian Sea that lies between Europe and Asia to Lake Titicaca in South America, have been shrinking.
That's the conclusion of a new study led by the University of Colorado Boulder, which showed 5.7 trillion gallons were lost from 1992 to 2020, an amount equivalent to what the U.S. used in all of 2015.
The report concludes that the major causes of decline are climate change, as lakes lose water to a hotter atmosphere, and unsustainable human consumption, with global warming being the larger of the two.
The team used satellite snapshots during a 28 period to survey the area of almost 2,000 of Earth's biggest lakes, finding that those in both dry and wet regions are losing volume.
The team concluded that man-made reservoirs were also losing water, with nearly two-thirds having significant losses. The decline resulted from sedimentation, where lakes fill up with rocks, sand, and gravel that would have otherwise flowed downstream.
In recent decades, scientists who wanted to monitor wildlife without being too intrusive have turned to collecting their DNA. Critters passing through an environment shed a treasure trove of information through pieces of skin, hair, or scales that can be genetically sequenced to reveal more about their health and identity.
The same goes for us humans. Maybe not scales, but whenever we breathe, sweat, or touch something, a bit of our DNA remains behind. And the information is there for the taking, which was the dilemma a team of researchers at the University of Florida raised in their recent work with sea turtles.
The scientists were using environmental DNA, or eDNA, to study viral tumors in endangered sea turtles by scooping up beach sand that baby hatchlings crawled across as they made their way to the ocean.
They expected to see DNA from other animals and maybe people, but the high quality of what they called human genetic bycatch set off alarm bells. Each of us has a unique genetic code, so could the researchers be collecting sensitive information?
To answer that question, they took samples from several Florida locations, including rivers, isolated beaches, and a remote island rarely visited by people.
In all but the island samples, they found DNA of such high quality, it contained markers for diseases and indicated the genetic ancestry of nearby populations. The team could even distinguish part of sex chromosomes from footprints volunteers left in the sand.
eDNA has proved useful in everything from conservation to epidemiology, such as recently helping to monitor COVID in wastewater. But it could also infringe on privacy, since harvested materials can reveal specifics of our health and ethnicity.
The study's authors want to continue using eDNA in research, but are calling for regulations to ensure it's used ethically and appropriately. And finally this week, good news about diapers, specifically the disposable ones piling up in landfills. A team of researchers in Japan has found a way to turn the nappy waste into housing and help combat global warming in the process.
In the U.S., over 4 million tons of disposable diapers are dumped annually, where they don't break down and emit methane. But because diapers are made of wood pulp, cotton, and superabsorbent polymers, researchers at the University of Kitakyushu say shreds of them could replace sand when making concrete.
That would be a win for the environment, as sand is dwindling worldwide, destructive to mine, and is the key ingredient in cement production, which is responsible for almost 7% of global greenhouse gas emissions.
In their study, the team washed, dried, and shredded diapers and combined them with cement, sand, gravel, and water. They tested different ratios of diaper shreds and found that mixing in just under one-third made the walls strong enough to support a single-story house they built in Indonesia.
Because populations are growing in lower-income countries, leading to more babies, more diapers, and more demand for housing, the authors say by using recycled materials, the cost of construction could be reduced to make homes more affordable.
That's it for this week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.